Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Andrew David James, only on LA Talk Radio.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Wow. Rock and roll comes to Sherman Oaks, California.
Maybe it'll brighten up this kind of gloomy day.
I tell you, that's right. Man, we got some talent in the studio today,
yes,
Michael.
Yes, we do.
Goodness
and a little
gracious.
Bit of beauty.
Great balls of fire. Yeah. That's right. I tell you. Well, here it is, March 1st, and man, the year is flying by.
It is, Andrew. And you know, each day we're just a little farther along.
That we are. You know, there's a whole lot of shaking going on here in the studio today. You know what I'm saying? Uh-huh.
We are thrilled
to have four unbelievably talented members of Million Dollar Quartet here with us today to talk about this outstanding show now on stage at the Cerritos Center for the Performing Arts.
Yes, through March 4th.
That's right.
That's just this coming weekend.
That's
here,
right.
Right? You've got to go see this, man. This is like, hello.
More talent storming.
Yes, more talent.
My
has
goodness.
Entered the studio.
we've got everybody but Zach here. No, that's true. We're missing two.
Yes.
Missing two. But man, this is, I tell you, the energy out there today when I walked in, it was like walking into a Beatles concert all those years ago.
It was
palpable.
Just in our lobby?
Palpable. That's right. You want to know what I heard, Michael?
Yeah.
When I first walked in, this is what
yeah.
I heard. I thought they were screaming for me, but they were apparently screaming for these good-looking guys. Can you believe that? Yeah. That was all the girls outside. That's just a glimpse of what goes on.
That sounded like a technical error.
That's what goes on outside of our studio every day, right?
Oh, my goodness.
Man. Oh, man. Now, I got to tell you, when I went to go see this show,
yeah.
I took my 7-year-old.
Yeah.
And, you know, you take a 7-year-old to a show over 20 minutes, you know you might be in trouble. And the minute that guitar kicked in, boy, he was focused on that stage, rocking, kicking his feet. He's the youngest person in the audience by probably 20 years. Having a great time. Stayed with it the entire 90-minute show. Loved it and left going, Daddy, we got to get more Elvis in the car. So, yeah, he had a really good time. This was a lot of fun. So this show has one more weekend. And not only that, but when you look at kind of what this show has done, have audiences been great, guys? Have audiences been amazing the whole time?
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, Michael, let's tell the people who we're talking to today.
Absolutely. Do you want to start that up there or what?
Let's go ahead and let's just give everybody the names of the multiple people in the studio here today in our crowded studio.
We are walking the line with our intro here, so I think it's time to bring out the guests. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Cole, Michael Monroe Goodman, John Countryman, and Adrian Visnick from the cast of Million Dollar Quartet.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have a couple of other people.
We do.
In this show,
no
who
doubt
are
about
brilliant
it.
Because they are musically brilliant in this show.
That's right.
David Lamoureux, who is the musical director for the show, and Omar.
Hello.
Well, listen, I got to say, wow. Our audience ain't gonna let you guys leave, man. They love you too much. I got to say, well, no, they're gonna love you too much. Uh huh. Nothing. Come on, man. I was hoping I'd get music here. I gotta tell you, this show means something to me because I've heard the soundtrack so many times, but I've never had a chance to see it live. And you always go, oh man, they can't be as good as the real guys. They changed the world. Man, you walked in and you felt like you stepped in that studio. It was Elvis personified. It was Jerry Lee Lewis personified. You looked at these guys put up there and you realized that the characters are so endearing, but yes. The actors have so much to work with as far as their personalities, their musical talent, that, boy, this was a fun venture out there. And if anybody hasn't been down to Cerritos, it's a beautiful space as well. The show, of course, put up by the amazing 3D Theatricals.
Yeah, as always, they bring something extra special to that stage. And the direction, the Broadway set, all of that is usually in their shows, and if they don't have it, they make it themselves and replicate
it.
So it's a treat, and as we always say on this show, we beg you to put down the remote control, get away from that television set, get your family out to the theater and the live performing arts to support them because we need that badly.
That's right. And there's nothing that you can enjoy more than seeing family members light up at live performance. When we sit in front of the television, we sit back, we zone out. But when we go to see live performance, we lean in, we clap. And I think Mr. Dawson said it best when he said, you're the next character in this show as the audience. You got to clap your hands. You got to make some noise. And they certainly
That's
did that
right.
when I was there.
Right.
Well, we will obviously be back to talk to these amazing people more in just a minute. But before we do that, so you and I don't get kicked off the air, air. Yeah. We need to pay some bills.
Okay.
Let's do it.
We'll do it. We'd like to thank, ladies and gentlemen, Princess Cruises for coming on board. Notice how I put that in.
On board. Very well done.
As our presenting sponsors for State of the Arts during 2018, a pioneer in excellence on the high seas for meaningful travelers who seek enriching experiences, only Princess Cruises offers cruise vacations to help you come back new, providing fresh perspectives by connecting you with nature, culture, and loved ones in a new way.
One of the best-known names in cruising, Princess Cruises first set sail in 1965 with a single ship cruising to Mexico. Today, the line has grown to become the third largest cruise line in the world, renowned for innovative ships, an array of onboard options, including extravagant entertainment, an environment of exceptional customer service. A recognized leader in worldwide cruising, Princess Cruises carries approximately 1.7 million guests each year to more than 360 destinations worldwide aboard a fleet of 17 modern vessels.
We'd also like to acknowledge PerformingArtsLive.com, one of the Internet's most prominent listing sources for the live arts in Southern California. We're grateful to them for their support and having been with us for the past 7 years.
That's right. Obviously, great people there supporting the live and performing arts and reminding us how important it is to keep arts going here in our community.
Absolutely.
Michael, obviously, we have a lot to talk about
we
today.
Do.
But before we jump to that, real quick, how was your theatrical week?
You know,
anything interesting?
It wasn't. I was set to go to the Robbie Awards,
yeah.
And I did not. I wasn't able to make it at the last minute just due to a personal thing. And that would have been all I would have taken care of because I was still working on Million Dollar Quartet for
of course.
Cerritos and another show that I'm handling. So what about you?
It was busy. I was in the theater for Princess Ida a lot, doing the fight choreography there and dealing with a lot of other stuff. I did get out to see a couple shows. I saw a performance of Romeo and Juliet down in Orange County, which I enjoyed very much. Lots of good things going on, including the show we're talking about here today, Million Dollar Quartet. Michael, that show is put on by 3D Theatricals, as we said. How can people get tickets for it?
They can simply go to 3DTShows.org or 3DTheatricals.org. And the ticket opportunity will be right there on their screen.
I think the time has come, Michael.
Yeah.
Are you ready?
I think so.
Let's bring in the man sitting to my right here. Our first guest joined the cast of Million Dollar Quartet in 2013 when the show opened at Harrah's Casino in Las Vegas, where he covered the roles of Elvis Presley and Johnny Cash.
After almost a four-year run, he went on to reprise the role of Elvis in productions of Million Dollar Quartet at Midtown Arts Center in Fort Collins, Colorado, the Lyric Theater in Oklahoma City, and the Zach Theater in Austin, Texas, and Seven Angels Theater in Waterbury, Connecticut.
A recording artist and songwriter in his own right, he has performed his music throughout the world. His many accolades include being the youngest inductee to the International Rockabilly Hall of Fame and recently being awarded the Broadway World's Best Actor in a Musical for his portrayal of Elvis in Million Dollar Quartet.
He's here today, ladies and gentlemen, to tell us more about this exciting career of his, as well as his current appearance with our own 3D Theatricals production of Million Dollar Quartet. Please welcome to the show, Cole.
Yeah. Man, you hear him tuning up over here already. Listen to that. Oh.
Hey, everybody.
How you doing, Cole? It's good to see you, man.
Good to see you, too, man.
What a pleasure it was to see you in this show. I got to say, first off, the thing that impressed me the most, because Elvis has been portrayed a lot of times
and
a lot of different ways, and the core of your performance was Elvis's vulnerability and desire to play these songs. That's what he wanted more than anything else. Now, we see Elvis here before Graceland, before everything went a different direction, but we see a young man who is struggling to get his music out there like so many millions of other kids are today. You have an experience with that, right? You did that on your own as well before you took on this role.
I did. I definitely did. And my thing is that, you know, I grew up listening to those guys, you know, Johnny Cash and Elvis and all the Sun Records roster. So I love the music anyway. So that when I was coming up, I started to work with some of these guys and got to meet all these guys.
Wow.
I used to open shows for Carl Perkins
as
a teenager when I first started out. So, yeah, it was cool. So in that way, I felt like I got to live it, you know.
You were the link. You were the link to the next generation. That's absolutely true.
I think so. And that, you know, when they inducted me into the Hall of Fame, I think that was the reason, because I was this young guy kind of taking the music around the world, you know, and carrying the torch, as they would say. And it's just kind of neat how life works out.
That is a cool thing.
When did you become aware of Elvis's music? And
I was literally born a fan. My mom would play Elvis records literally when I was in the womb. And so my parents, they played the music. So I don't remember not being a fan. you know, so it was just kind of...
You came out ready to do some hip shaking, ready to move, man.
I came out ready to hip shake with sideburns. My mom said I actually had sideburns.
Wow. That must have been an interesting birthing experience. I got to tell you, this is a cool thing, too, because Elvis had a unusual life. And this was something that I'd heard before, but it's highlighted in the show a little bit. Elvis had a twin brother who passed away very shortly after birth. Is that correct?
I did not know
he
that.
Did.
Yeah. You know, the thing, I'll tell you the story about his name was Jesse Guerin, and he was born first. She didn't even know Gladys Presley was Elvis's mom. She didn't even know she had twins. This is before being able to go to...
No ultrasounds.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So she gave birth to the stillborn baby and thought that was it.
Wow. Oh, man.
Shortly thereafter, out pops Elvis, you know.
Wow.
And, you know, the thing back then, you know, there was... You had a nurse there at the house, and literally they just took that little baby, that unborn, you know, baby, and buried it in a shoebox, you know, in a backyard somewhere, you know.
Amazing.
But then Elvis went on to live for both of them.
And I think that is true, right? Sometimes the greatest heartbreak leads to the greatest success as well. I mean, that kind of pain, he talks about that. And I believe he had to pass his baby brother's grave every day on the way to school.
Wow.
And I think at one point he even said, you know, I feel like I'm living for two, which is an amazing thing. And I heard this somewhere, and I may not be correct on this, but I heard that they changed names at one point and accidentally put Elvis's name on the tombstone for a while. So he saw that when he was growing up. Yeah, you have to check that out. But I ran across that in my research the other day, and I thought, what a strange world, because we don't see that anymore. You know, our births are very sanitized, our lives are very sanitized. We go to the hospital, we come home in clean dressing gowns and such. And this was something that Elvis's life started off like so many rock and roll musicians, in absolute squalor, dealing with a whole lot of really hard things, which gave him so much soul, I think, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Have you all been to the estate in Memphis?
Everyone? Many times, yeah.
It's kind of, for the first one, I've only been once, and it was, you know, kind of wonderfully weird and interesting,
yeah,
and kind of like bigger than life, you know. And I had the, have any of you, no, you were much too young, I had a meal with Elvis Presley.
Wow.
My goodness, how cool is that?
And I was...
Peanut butter and banana?
Right.
Uh-huh. I'd say I was 7 years old. My parents were very hooked up in Las Vegas, and we used to go up frequently and stay at the Sahara Hotel in its heyday. And I was very precocious. And
no,
I used
you.
we were all down at the pool, and I frequently went to the lobby of the hotel and used the white courtesy telephone to call the operator to ask her to have myself paged because I wanted to hear my name, you know, going through the hotel lobby of the casino and outdoors by the pool. Where
this
my
is why his name
was.
Comes first in our intro, too, just so everybody knows. Yeah.
So, and they were very kind to me, and they said, okay, Mr. Sterling, and they would do that, and then I'd walk out, and I'd be so happy, and nobody knew, you know,
right.
But my family was out there, like, rolling their eyes. So I had befriended one of the fellows, the room service guys, and he said, hey, Michael, come here, and he had this big tray, and he said, come with me. He said, I think you're going to have some fun with this. And I said, where are we going? And he said, well, just follow me. So we go up into the tower of the Sahara Hotel to the penthouse. And he says, now stay about 5 or 6 feet behind me, and I'll give you a little cue when you can walk up. And so I so wide-eyed, I didn't really understand it, but I did what he told me to do. And he knocked on the door, and the door opened, and there stood Elvis in a white terry cloth robe. And his hair was messed up, and my pal there, you know, gave me a signal, so I walked up a little bit closer, and Elvis looked out in the hallway. He said, and who are you, young man? And I said, I'm Michael Sterling. You must have heard me, you know. The hotel.
I'm well known in this hotel.
He said, well... He said, I'm getting ready to have my breakfast. Have you had yours? And I said, absolutely not, sir. And he said, well, come on in. Let's have some breakfast. So I sat down with this man, and I was speechless through most of it. But when I left and went back down to the pool and told my family where I had been, again, they rolled their eyes.
Right. Lion. Well, now, am I correct that you had a meal with Elvis? Did you also have a meal with all four Beatles?
I didn't have a meal with all four Beatles, but I had many cocktails with
that
them.
That is rarefied air, my friend. Exactly. Rarefied air to sit with both of those. That's amazing. Of course,
the Plaza Hotel in New York after our closing concert of the George Harrison tour, which was
unbelievable.
Yeah, it was pretty neat.
Pretty cool. That's right. Well, Cole, I've got to ask you one more time here. This is as we kind of talk about, you know, your musical legacy and all this sort of thing and how you got with the show. You've been with the show on multiple occasions. How does the show differ? Because it is the same performances. You know, the songs are fairly well known. Everybody wants to see them done the traditional way. How does it vary with cast to cast to cast when you're working with different people? And also, what's it like to go from covering Elvis to covering Johnny Cash?
Well, to answer the first question, you know, they're all a little bit different because each actor brings their own feel to it and their own energy. So, but with this particular show, they cast a bunch of veterans. So yeah. We had all come up with the original director, you know, Eric Schaefer's direction,
sure.
And Chuck Mead's musical direction, and so we're all familiar with that. So with this particular production, it's pretty dang close to right from the, you know, the original ways of doing the show.
That's
some of
great.
These other regional productions that are out there right now, they're okay, but a lot of guys that are just kind of, they didn't have that original training, so they're kind of, you know, it's definitely makes for a different show. As far as playing.
Different intent, I would assume, too.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You got to have a heart for it, too. I mean, you got to really live this music. It's not as easily cast, per se, as some of these others because
I'm
you got to
sure.
play. And you gotta,
absolutely.
You know. And Johnny Cash, they're both actually, they're very different but very similar, believe it or not. You know, so it's, I enjoy doing both. It's just, you know, somehow you flip that switch and you go from Elvis to, hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
Very cool. I got to ask you this, too. Now, if I were to take John Countryman, who plays the amazing Jerry Lee Lewis and does it fantastically well throughout the entire show, and I think could keep going for 3 more hours. I honestly think that man could play piano without stopping for 3 hours. If I took him, and I found myself a quiet little room with a piano, and I had him start at the beginning of Elvis's catalog, is there any song he'd get to that you didn't know by heart?
No.
I didn't think so. This is a cool group of guys, and I want to keep them in studio all the time. But
yeah,
we got to move on.
Yes, we do.
Shall we bring in this next gentleman coming up here?
Absolutely.
All right. Our next guest has been connected to music his whole life, even having been named after the father of bluegrass, Bill Monroe. He grew up backstage at the Grand Ole Opry with his family friend and music legend Monroe, which led to quite a musical foundation.
He's released albums with a blend of country, rockabilly, and bluegrass, which he calls Kentucky Fried Tonk. His debut album was titled Unbreakable Heart, quickly followed by No Filter and The Flag, The Bible, and Bill Monroe.
He's appeared on film and TV, but certainly his roots are in old soul. As an old soul musician, he appeared as Justin in New Country with Den Theater, and as Young Johnny in Ring of Fire with both Mercury Theater and Arizona Theater Company. He was Huey Calhoun in Memphis with Musical Theater West, and Elvis Presley in the national tour of Million Dollar Quartet.
He then musically directed and played Carl Perkins in Totem Pole Playhouse's production of Million Dollar Quartet. He's here today to talk with us about reprising this role with the D-Theatricals, as well as his role as associate musical director in the production. Please welcome Michael Monroe Goodman.
Yeah. Michael, good to talk to you. Hey, I love your hat.
Thank you.
So when my grandfather passed away, I inherited all of his fedoras from the 1940s and 50s,
yeah,
right? And, of course, I didn't want to wear them because I didn't want to bleach them out in the sun, and I was playing around with one of them one day. I was trying the hat flip. That's
mm-hmm.
just what you do
did.
When
yeah,
you're
yeah,
16
yeah,
and inherit a bunch of fedoras. And I felt around in the rim, and there his Army Corps of Engineers card from 1944 was in there.
Oh,
isn't that
really
a cool,
cool
story? Yeah, yeah, very cool.
Cool.
So I don't wear much of my long hair anymore. So got to tell me, Bill Monroe, what an amazing thing to grow up and to know him. How did that form your personality and your love of music?
I mean, I don't think I realized it until I was like 15, 16 years old how much of an influence it was. And to me, growing up, he was just like Uncle Bill, and and just never had any clue the monumental influencer he was. And growing up as a kid, you know, we'd like backstage at the Grand Ole Opry a couple times a month, just hanging out with, you know, Dolly Parton, Barb Mandrill, and Marty Robbins stuff.
Man,
and I just
wow.
got like photo albums of them, you know, they all wanted to hold the cute kid or whatever. I used to be cute. And so, you know, I grew up with that and just didn't think of it. I grew up thinking, and everyone in my family sang gospel music. I grew up thinking that like singing wasn't a big deal. I thought like everyone in the world was a good singer just because I grew up in that environment. It wasn't until I was in like middle school and they had an assembly and somebody went to school and sang a solo and everybody lost their mind. I was like, what's the big deal? And then that's when I realized, like a light bulb, when I was like, oh, people might want to hear me sing. And then I just, you know, kind of went from there. But I mean, I didn't know, you know, I was a rebellious teenager and I was into like all what was popular then, Green Day and Nirvana and all that stuff like that, and kind of cut my teeth just like learn how to play guitar and stuff like that. But the roots really caught up with me, especially when Bill died. When Bill died and I went to the funeral, and just like it realized to me how much he meant to me. And to this day, if I like hear his voice talking or whatever, it's like I just start crying. I can't. It's like it's just such a, because like Cole said, like I was backstage at Opry when my mom was pregnant. So like I've heard that voice, you know, ever since for forever. And so it's just like it's such a soulful connection or something.
Wow. Is it the same today, the old Opry, if you go there in more recent times? Is it the same? Is it the same experience?
No, I mean, everything changes over the years. I mean, I haven't been to the Opry probably in 20 years. Wow. Last time I was there, I was probably 18 or 19 backstage. But, I mean, the show is different because the music scene in Nashville's changed or whatever.
Right.
They're still, luckily, you can go to the Opry and you'll still see some of the greats, you know, that are still on the program there, and they get to come out and sing, and then you see some new people that are really talented, you know, and you get to, I think the best part about if you go to the Opry today, the way it was back then, you see the famous people there, but you also see like some gospel groups come out or some cloggers or whatever else that you don't see on, you know, here on national radio, but they're very much a fabric of the history of country music. You go there and see the Grand Opry, and you really, really
and it's still a very prestigious, you know, venue to. I mean if you play there,
it's the most prestigious. You know, that's every country singer's goal.
The wild thing for me, I never really took to country music until more recently, in the past maybe 3 or 4 years, and to see the extraordinary embracement by this country of country music, because it did the right thing. It took the turn into country pop, and it made music available now to younger ears that would not have perhaps listened to it before. And you look at the Country Music Awards, and these guys are superstars, all of them that are coming out there on that stage and selling millions and millions of records.
Yeah.
And it's very exciting, I think, for the sake of music in general, because I would rather hear something that I actually can understand the story of and the lyrics of coming out of that person's mouth than anything else. And there's not too much of that left in music today.
That's true.
No,
right?
There's not. That's true.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So now you've got a CD of your own out, correct, Michael?
Yeah, I've got two.
I heard
full
a little bit. These are great.
CDs.
I mean, this is all original music, correct?
Yeah, right.
You don't
along.
Do covers, which is great.
No, I haven't done a cover album yet. I'm looking at doing a cover album pretty soon. I'm going to do like a Sun tribute album, do like my takes on stuff and some other ideas and stuff for covering other people's songs. But yeah, I pretty much just focus on songwriting. I kind of feel like that's my strongest suit. I've just been songwriter since.
Along
I was
with
a little
acting
kid.
And singing and musical directing and everything else you do, that's your strongest?
Yeah. I kind of think it is my strongest thing is songwriting. People ask me all the time, you know, like, you know, they'll look down your nose like, oh, are you an actor or are you a singer? What
right.
are you? You know, you have to pick.
Don't
one
put
or
me
whatever.
In a box. You can't put you baby know. In a corner, man. Come on.
And for a lot of time, I like battle that. I'm like, am I wasting time or whatever? But I really figured out what it is that my blessing from God is that I'm a storyteller ever since I was
young.
That's
a good way of putting it.
And so sometimes I'm doing it through songs. Sometimes I'm getting to do it on stage or whatever. I grew up around great storytellers. So I think it's just what I like doing. So I like writing stories. I like writing songs. So that's what I really get fired up about.
Being on stage with these people sitting next to you every night, what is that experience like?
I mean, it's hard to describe. I mean, I think I've been doing it with most of these people so long. It's like I think I've kind of got numb to how amazing it is.
Just feels like home.
Because it's so home. It's like I'm, you know, all these guys on the show are just all amazing musicians. And just phenomenal, and we do such a great job just rocking it out, and we have such a chemistry, especially with the guys I never worked before, with David and Omar. You know, they're such great musicians. They're just locked right in. So we really play like a band that's been together for a long time, you know, which is really hard to do in a jukebox musical.
It's remarkably true, yeah.
You know, and so from day one of rehearsal, you know, the rhythm section was just right there. So it's like, you know, everything's good to go from there. But yeah, I mean, it's just, it's so great having fun and little discoveries every night, you know, with theater. It's real great musically. You get to kind of do a little something different every day, take a different take on a guitar solo, or you know, you have a little back and forth,
exactly.
Whatever, you know, so there's that.
It's never new. Two performances.
Yeah, alike. Never. And there's always like the give and take with acting, you know, you get like a little joke line you didn't get another night because someone, you know, gave you a different take and you're able to use that and back forth, you know, and you discover little great moments, you know, because, I mean, it's different with every cast because Everybody has their own like pacing and their own sense of humor and stuff. So you got to like, it takes a little while to like get that pacing where it's one gelled thing, you know, and then when you do, then it's just really, you know, it's really great because you get all the beats and you get all the moments together and it's really great.
Well,
it's
you got it now, believe me. You have it. You all have it. I was very blown away by the opening night in Redondo Beach, and I just sat back in my seat and my jaw was just like open. I've seen the show before, quite frankly,
yeah.
But I did not have the same reaction to it as I did seeing it this time.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, it was really...
That's great.
A must. So,
well, we have a lot more to get to, but
yeah, we do.
Shall we take a moment and beg these people to sing for us a little bit here?
Yeah.
Maybe even do a little guitar picking, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Hey, what do you guys got for us today?
Well, we got an old gospel number that we do in the show. You know, when these guys got together at Sun Records on December 4th, 1956, the one thing that they all had in common was their love for spiritual and gospel music. So in the original recordings, that's what they're really singing. And this is one of the songs that they did that that afternoon. Holy down on my burden. Down by the riverside, down by the riverside, down by the riverside. Oh, lay down my burden, down by the riverside. I ain't gonna study for no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study. Oh, no more, Brother Lewis.
Well, I'm gonna drive home in my new Cadillac down by the riverside. Oh, yeah, down by the riverside. Right there by that riverside. I'm gonna drive home in my new white Cadillac down by the riverside. I'm gonna study Ford's no more. Well, yes, sir.
Well, I ain't gonna study more no more. Ain't gonna study more no more. Well, I ain't gonna study more no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Well, I lay down on my sword and shield down by the riverside. Down by the riverside. Down by the riverside. Hold it down on my sword and shield down by the riverside. Ain't gonna study war no more. No more, no more, no more. Well, ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more.
Beautiful.
And I'd like everybody to know I sang harmony on that. I was the one that I was back there somewhere just mixed into the crowd, just so everybody knows. What an amazing... And this song is, of course, in the show, and it's a great highlight of the show as well. It's interesting. The Sun Record recordings were just released here a few years ago, of course, and this was put in there from this strange session that kind of been lost to history. And I sat next to a gentleman, 85 years old, who was at the show that day, and he said, I lived in Memphis during that time, and I'd heard that this has happened in my home state, you know, and he said it was always kind of like a rumor that this had happened. You know, some, I mean, they saw the pictures and all that, but everybody thought maybe it was just. And he said when they were released in the 90s, he went out and bought the CD. And the man, when he told this, and of course he wasn't really talking to me as much as my 7-year-old, who still is cute. And it's, you know, they're sitting there, they're having this conversation, but he had this wealth of passion and feeling in his eyes, and you could tell how much that music defined his generation. It was a cool thing to see.
So shall we move on?
Let's do it.
Let's do this. Yes. Growing up, ladies and gentlemen, in a musical family, our next guest listened to the raucous piano recordings of Jerry Lee Lewis at the urging of his piano teacher mother and discovered a kindred spirit. In 2009, he joined the band The Dirty Names, launching his career as a musician and performer. In 2013, he joined the national tour of Million Dollar Quartet as his idol, Jerry Lee Lewis.
He has continued on with this role in Chicago, Las Vegas, Branson, and now here in Los Angeles. We are so happy to have him in studio with us today to tell us more about this latest production with 3D Theatricals. Please welcome the amazing, the talented John Countryman to the show.
Yeah. Yeah.
Welcome, man. So glad to have you. Now, I got Jerry Lee Lewis. You got to find the antagonist in the show, right? You're like, okay, well, where's the conflict come from? And brother, it's you, man.
It's
there's
me.
No doubt. But it's interesting. It's interesting because you do that in such an endearing way. I think, you know, this is one of those shows where you watch it and you kind of like, man, I love that rock and roll spirit that comes out of all of them. But unrefined in Jerry Lee Lewis, that's a fun thing to watch.
It's
no doubt about
it.
Seriously, how you are so limber, you are so agile, you are so all of those things in this performance, and every woman in the audience wants to take you home because that's what I heard
I'm not even sure what to respond to that, huh? Too bad I'm so tuckered out after the show. I have to just go straight home and ice my entire body. Sorry, ladies. Meet me by the stage door. I have to leave somehow.
So I'm going to go ahead and hashtag ice my entire body. Sorry,
yeah,
ladies. Here.
Do you to that, to the extraordinary performance that you give out in this show, physically and emotionally, how do you prep for that?
Do you have years, I've been a fan, much like everybody else here. I've been a fan since, I guess, In Utero is the theme here. I mean, like, you know, like, my mom also was a big Elvis fan, and like you said, is the piano teacher. And I took lessons as a kid, and I learned a little bit, but wasn't very interested in it. I mean, I learned, like, a Bach two-part invention and a watered-down maple leaf rag. And then my mom showed me some, like, boogie-woogie stuff when I was about 12 years old, and I just really dug it, and I liked the music, I liked the energy, and I like Jerry Lee's, you know, rock and roll energy. And so I've just been doing this, having been a fan, and now the show for so long that it's seems like second nature in some ways, you know.
But I mean, physically, do you do any sort of breathing exercises?
Oh, yeah.
Physical
exercises?
You
gotta warm up. Yeah, you gotta loosen the neck up. Yeah. You know, work the back out the whole night. Moshing over there for an hour and a half without, you know, pulling my neck, because I'm gonna be like coming out cook it or whatever, but no.
You kick plenty of ass in this show, man. So it is brilliant, and you look like you're having the greatest time.
I am. I'm having a fantastic time. This is the gift. It's the gig that keeps on gigging, and the gift that keeps on giving. So I will be here with bells on. Yeah.
Now, I hear a rumor that a woman left
on...
It's not true.
Whatever it is, don't listen.
Cell phones are everywhere now, man. Yeah. You can't deny it anymore. I hear a woman left the theater on opening night of 3D Theatricals production of Million Dollar Quartet and said, well, I just don't believe that that was all real. Nobody can play a piano like that, you know? And is that true? Is that people watching this and going, there's no way this guy's doing this, you know?
Yeah, I get that a lot. Because right now, I'm actually in Branson, Missouri doing the show, and we do like a little like picture autograph line after the show.
Right.
And I've had this happen so many times where like a little old lady will come up and be like, is that you playing the piano? And I'll be like, no, ma'am, no, it wasn't. She's like, I knew it! And I was like, it's
lied.
Me, I promise, it's me. I like.
Well, I've got a lot to thank you for, and you have to answer for this here on the radio in front of thousands and thousands of people across the planet.
Okay.
My little boy has been taking piano lessons for about a year and a half now, and after we got home from this show, I walked into the living room, and his heel was up on those piano keys of the new electric piano we just bought him. So, yeah, so you're going to be coming over to clean my piano, young man.
You got to get him some little dress shoes. Like, the key is, no, for real, the key to doing the slide up and down the keys is you got to have, like, a hard sole.
peel.
It can't, yeah. It's not, can't be rubber, because that'll pull the keys right off. So if you've got the hard sole, that's how you slide up and down the keys. And
yeah, I don't think his Skechers were doing it for him. So.
Yeah, no, the Skechers aren't going to work.
Got to get yourself some two-tone spats up. That was
exactly.
Interesting
to
see.
Little spats.
Now, do you break keys on this piano the way you play? You've got to break a few keys.
You know what? We use a keyboard for the show for that very reason, because the keyboards have better longevity in the long run. Because ultimately, yes, you will snap strings. The poor piano I learned to play on we just had to give it away. I mean, it was rekindling it by the time I was done with it. I had broken most of the higher two octaves and half of the low octaves where I was playing. So my mom, her poor piano. But the keyboards work out, they last longer. So hopefully no keys. We're almost done with this run, so not yet.
Right.
But I've got time. If anybody wants to come see the show this weekend, I will break a key for you, and I'll meet you by the stage door.
It's a promise. He'll sign it and
autograph
it.
I'll bring you a souvenir.
It'll cost you something, though, I'm sure. Right?
White keys, black keys, I've got 88. Your choice. Yeah. You asked me to be on the radio. This is what happened. I mean, like,
we love that about you.
Yeah, I love it.
Mr. Lewis is still performing out there every once in a while.
The only member of the quartet who's still alive. Yeah.
Have you had the pleasure of meeting him?
I haven't had the pleasure of meeting him. I've seen him perform a couple times.
Well, we have him here today. So, ladies.
I knew it was going to work out. Jerry, come on out.
What a cool thing, though, obviously. And you're playing a historical character who at any moment could show up and be at the back of the audience. You know, I mean, isn't that kind of an interesting thing, too? Do you change your process at all when you're preparing for historical character versus somebody who's fictional?
No, I would say in the sense that Jerry Lee, like for this show particularly, like a lot of the characters kind of have their arc. And yes, you got to have like what's cool about our show is that we take a lot of history and condense it. So the night of, you know, December 4th, 1956 was a very special night that everybody just kind of hung out and jammed. But in our show, we have some story involved too, where we kind of find out what's going on with Carl and Johnny and all that. So for the show, I come in, I kind of have, the role that I play is sort of the funny antagonist as well as the piano extraordinaire. Right. So that, to me, you know, it's like, yes, you try to keep it grounded in reality, but also knowing that, like, some of the things we say in the show are kind of shticky. I mean, like, in the terms of, like, you know, he just came off the mule or whatever it is. That, you know what I mean? Like, it's ridiculous. And nobody in the South even says that stuff anymore or ever did. But it doesn't matter. It's a show. And so for me, coming in, I know the part that I have to play is to be a little heightened, you know, much like most of the characters that we're portraying. Anyway, these guys were wild and crazy back in their heyday anyway. So,
well, you mentioned something in the show in character. You mentioned that Jerry Lee Lewis is Jimmy Swaggart's cousin.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And Mickey Gilley's cousin, too. They all grew up together, learning to play on the same piano. And
that's amazing.
Parody, yeah.
Wow. That's a lot of energy in that family. No doubt about it.
You ain't kidding, yeah.
Well, gentlemen, we have we have gotten through these three talented dudes, but I got to be honest, this is why we're doing the show today. Our next guest, ladies and gentlemen, that's right. Our final guest today is a true triple threat, an actress, singer, and dancer. In addition to her many TV and film credits, she was a top finalist in LA's Next Great Stage Star and appeared as Cruella De Vil in Disney's Villains Counting Scars musical video.
She was nominated as Best Female Cabaret Artist by Broadway World for her West Coast headlining debut solo cabaret Sunny Side Up at Sterling's Upstairs at the Federal in the NoHo Arts District of North Hollywood. She appeared in the Edinburgh Fringe Festival production of Carnal Desire, a satire, and as Babette in The Real Housewives of Toluca Lake at the Falcon Theater.
She played the role of Sage in the musical comedy Inside Out in Los Angeles and Corey and Neil Simon's Barefoot in the Park at the Lyric Hypernium.
She joins us today to talk about the sultry, sexy, and stirring vocals she brings to her current role as Diane in Million Dollar Quartet. Please give it up for Adrienne Visnick.
What a pleasure to have you back on. Now, talk about versatility. We last saw you, or at least I last saw you, in The Real Housewives of Toluca Lake at the Falcon Theater.
It was fun. At the now Gary Marshall Theater.
Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. In fact, good things going on over there. We'll talk
really
more about
things.
That in coming weeks as well.
And
I got an email from them, some exciting stuff coming up over there. But one of the things that blew me away was the difference in ambiance and essence that you had to deliver in this character, right? I told you my little boy was like, why would anybody ever play another role? I was trying to explain how actresses take different jobs.
You can't be a housewife every day.
He said, does she do this all the time? And I said, well, yes, she's an actress.
Seven. Like 17?
I said, she's an actress, so she takes different jobs, right? And he said, well, why wouldn't she just sing these songs all the time? She's so good. So there apparently,
yay.
So you may have a lifelong role here, but...
Well, and what a switcheroo from playing Corey.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah. Barefoot in the Park. Neil Simon. Go into this.
Yeah,
where
totally.
You just kind difference. Of. When you sing Fever Baby, you are singing it. Yeah. Oh.
Well, now, is this a historical character that you play? She wasn't.
So there was a woman that was there. Her name is Marilyn Evans, but she wasn't a singer. And she actually wasn't really interested in music, in rock and roll music either.
She was a dancer, wasn't she?
She was a dancer. She was a Vegas dancer.
Right. And she was there with Elvis, is that correct?
She was there with Elvis. Oh, okay. She was his girlfriend for what, Cole? Like 2 weeks?
5 minutes.
Yeah, which
five
is minutes. A long time for Elvis, so yeah.
5 minutes. But she was one of the few girlfriends that never said, hey, I was Elvis's girlfriend, and they had to find her. She's still living in Chicago.
I understand
she's 89 years old.
She found out about it through a feature story in the Los Angeles Times.
No, really?
That they were doing Million Dollar Quartet. It was becoming a musical.
And that's
these characters.
That. Yeah.
And isn't she something like 90?
Yeah, she's 90 years old. She lives in Chicago, and she just has never claimed that she was Elvis. She just didn't, like, rock and roll wasn't her thing. And so they had to.
It was for one night.
Exactly, yeah. So now Diane is kind of just like a combination of all of his girlfriends. So.
And that
she's
demure,
a more fabulous
that
woman.
Photo of you on top of the piano.
Oh, yes, my tambourining skills. Yes, I now know how to tambourine on the 2 and 4 instead of the 1 and 3. It's great.
Hey, you be careful. That's hard for some of us. Back off.
I thought I was, like, pretty groovy, and then everyone was like, Adrian, you're clapping wrong.
Did you just use the word groovy?
I am. I'm very groovy.
She's a happening chick.
I'm very groovy.
I got to say, this was interesting to watch this because you definitely need a female actress in there. You need somebody in there to kind of break up this male testosterone show. I don't know, testosterone?
That's the Italian.
That's the actual San Francisco trait. I don't know. But it's interesting where you look at this and you see that the writing to put a female character in there and give her some kind of feeling and some a different dynamic to break up this masculine sort of feel that the recording session had. And it was funny to see how much you needed that to play off all four of the boys, all six of the boys really, but certainly all four of the principal characters, in that you watched it and you said, people do react a little differently depending on who's in the room. You know, and Elvis had an invested interest in really doing this, you know, vested interest in really making this work. And I think it did add a little bit to certainly our buddy Zach Ford, who had to play a little bit more of the gentleman, a little more of the housekeeper to keep all these personalities in check. That was a lot of fun to see, too.
And you know, Zach doesn't get that opportunity very often to play a non-singing role.
That's
because
right.
He's got such a fantastic voice.
Great
himself.
Voice. Yeah.
We last saw him in Oklahoma. Oklahoma,
And a nice man.
And of course, today we're missing David Elkins, who's so wonderful in the role of Johnny Cash.
Mm-hmm. He's had an audition that conflicted with the time.
Working
actor.
The rest
afterlife.
Of you at auditions. Get out there, guys. What's the matter with you? Beat the pace.
David, we hope you
But obviously, this show is a little bit different in that you're playing so many historical characters and people come in with expectations. Was that hard to know that people were going to come in with expectations of what they wanted to see there?
You know, I really had no sense of, you know, what the show really is until we had an audience.
Wow.
And then you start hearing people screaming once they see Elvis on stage, or once they see these idols on stage, and you're like, oh, this is, it's a full concert. It's not really it's not a musical theater show. It's a concert, and you're part of something that's, it's bringing joy to people who really love this time period. And there's something even more special about that, of being on stage with these guys who are so musically talented, and then to watch people really just having the times of their lives out there and dancing away. So it's great.
Cool.
It's really, really cool.
Well, you know, this, like the great American standards, this type of music, rock and roll from that era is what needs to be regenerated and regenerated through years and years ahead of us.
You know, there's some of my, I mean, I knew most of the songs going into this, but I have some friends who came to see the show and they're like, oh, there's a lot of songs in there I didn't know. And I was like, what? So it's good to but it's good to, you know, it's good to have people come. It's, you know, it's good to have every generation coming to see this show, which is really cool. Yeah.
Well, being that you are the most beautiful cast member
thank
in this
you
show,
so much.
And the
only it's only because I wasn't in the show. You be
I know,
careful.
I know.
And you've done so much on stage and in your lovely career, and it's a young career, but you certainly got out there and worked. And it's come that time of the show need to ask the question.
And now, embarrassing moments.
Well, you know who we're going to start with? We're going to start with Omar.
Man.
Omar!
You know why? Because you're the only one with headphones on. That's why you got thrown under the bus.
You must have an embarrassing moment. Now, this man is a musical genius there on stage, too. He's in the back there with David Lamoureux, another musical genius. And they are associate musical directors. And Omar?
I just got bumped.
Take it.
Where's that
picture? Yeah, I got to talk.
Plays Jay Perkins in the show, of course, right?
Brother Jay.
The brother, yeah, the brother of Carl, of course. Do you have an embarrassing moment? Now, I know you're normally perfect. I know that you've never made any mistakes, but other people around you, perhaps.
That's true. I guess I'll have to make something up. First of all, it's so, you know, like when you go into an audition and you say, hey, do you sing? Yeah, and they say, okay, sing us a song. And then you respond with, what do you want to hear? They say, sing anything, and then you can't think of anything.
Right.
So that's what I'm going through right now. So this is the one that might not be safe for work. But anyway, I'll say it anyway, so you decide. So I was doing a production of A Chorus Line in Chicago. And there's the big finale. I don't know if you all know Chorus Line, whatever.
Sure.
You all go off stage, and then the big finale where everyone gets dressed in, like, the gold suits and the hats.
Right.
And this show was in the round, which was weird to do a chorus line in the round, but they made it work. It was weird. So at the very end, you know, we're doing the big triangle, and we're going in the circle. And during rehearsals and tech, I was like, oh, it's a little, like, it's one piece that you jump in. I'm like, oh, it's a little tight here. Can we make it loose here? Otherwise, I feel like it's going to rip. The costume designer's like, no, you'll be fine, you'll be fine. Well, don't you know, during a show in audience, I'd have to get in there so fast, quick, change everything, shoes and everything, and my costume ripped. So I had to do the whole number with costume. Now, where it ripped was my entire behind.
which just means we raised ticket prices a little bit, right? Come on now.
Is that what you're saying? Yeah. It was exposed for the entire finale. That's image that the audience got. So
wish you wore a tux with tails, don't you?
But you were aware of it?
Yeah, that's why it was embarrassing, because I was aware of it before it happened. I was backstage changing, and I was like, oh, this ripped, and there's no time. Like, there's no time, and everyone's laughing for the finale.
But now you got through this, and now surely every time you put a costume on, you check the back of your pants a little bit, don't you? I still do that today after I split a costume years ago. I'm still like, just because it can't happen ever again, please.
Yeah, I was a teenager when this happened, so yes, I've definitely learned to test costumes in the way that I need to do them in the show.
You give them like a stress test, a couple squats in the dressing room just to make sure.
Michael, you must have one.
What's that?
You must have one.
An embarrassing moment, something that happened early on in your career that maybe made you think that things couldn't get worse, that you couldn't survive it, but the show must go on.
You have 1 minute. Come up to the microphone there.
Well, this wouldn't be that early on, but there was one time that I'm really, really embarrassed about. When we were in doing Million Dollar Quartet in Chicago, and I was covering Cash that night, and I missed my exit. I meant my entrance. I missed my entrance.
Actors try to miss their exits. I'm not leaving. I'm staying on stage.
But I was backstage getting ready to make my entrance.
Oh, no.
During the middle of the show, and the prop guy was like talking to me and got distracted. And he's usually real good at like cueing people, and he got distracted. And he's like, "Oh crap!"
You were lulled in. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I like walk in, and our Jerry Lee there just like started like improvising a song. I walk in, and it's like, and it was.
You be careful,
really,
Countryman's going to lock you in the bathroom, so he gets another number.
I could use the extra like 45 seconds. I can do that for you. Talk to David and see if he'll miss his entrance and improvise. Yeah, and the producers were there that night, so I was like, oh, I got to look them right in the face.
Yeah, it didn't keep you from getting cast again, though, so that's a good thing.
Yeah, still works.
Amazing. Well, obviously, these things happen, and you know, we've had so many on this show. Cole, you got anything for us?
I do. I don't know if I should tell the story or not. This just came to mind, and it's Million Dollar Quartet related, so I'll share it.
Very nice.
In Las Vegas, we had the very wonderful Victoria Matlack that played Elvis's girlfriend Diane in the show. Victoria's amazing, but she's a tall girl, you know. And so, and I'm almost 6 feet tall myself. But anyways, I thought, you know what? I'm tired of going out there and being a little bit shorter than her. I'm gonna roll up a sock and put it at the back of my heel inside my shoe. You know? So I do this, and then I'm up there. You know, and Elvis is doing all these moves. So about halfway through the show, I'm popping these moves. I'm going across. Well, the sock rolls out from out of his shoe and rolls across the stage. Now, everybody on the stage can see this, and they're thinking, what is that? And so, but no one could laugh. And to the audience, it's coming out of my pants, you know. So it looks like I'm Tom Jones in the show, and I'm thinking, I'm really not. It was that much, but you can't tell anybody that. Anyway, that was pretty impressive.
Tom Jones in the show. I love it. I love it. Uh-oh, ladies and gentlemen.
David Lamoureux, you must have something for
us. You can step right up here to the mic if you want.
Yeah.
You got an embarrassing moment?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. I mean, I've got something embarrassing just from this rehearsal process on this show that we did. I would say on anything where I think that I get to play drums in front of an audience, so like there's the, you know, there's how hard you play, just to naturally play how hard you play. But if you're on tour with a rock band or if you're doing a show where the band's on stage, like there's extra sauce on it no matter what. Right. Like you dial in extra like little swaggery physicalities that you think look good, and then, you know, years later people are like, oh man, you looked like a nut in that show. But the set that we were fortunate in this rehearsal process to, we rehearsed with full sound almost and full set. So the set was built in the rehearsal hall. We had the show console in, all the mics were live. But in one, I don't know, a particularly energetic moment, I suppose, but where I was just, everything was going great and carried away. And just like a little leaning too far back, usually on a set that has like walls behind you, it feels like, oh, I'll catch myself, whoops, klutz. But this set has no walls. It's just like stretched out fabric on this PVC A-frame. So it turned into, you know, a full fall back, kick the snare over, like take the set down. And we have a wonderful stage management team on the show, but they're both you know, older women, so it's just that sense of like, you know, this six, almost four, 180-something pound guy goes, and like the source team that rushes in to help is thinking it's much worse because they're, you know, manifesting what it would look like on their grandchildren happening to them. But anyway.
You just hop up and pretend you're doing an Elvis move, man. It's okay. You're in good shape.
if there was any prayer that I could pull it off and convince anyone that that's what I was trying to do, I think the odds would have been better that I would have tried, but it, generally speaking, when something like that happens, I just raise my hands and go like, "Oh, it's me." That
Joys
me
of live theater.
Oh, my goodness, John.
Let's see. First off, sadly, I'm not really embarrassed by anything anymore.
I can believe that.
Any embarrassing stories for me personally? Embarrassing.
I have a few.
I can share. Yeah, I have a wealth of
that story. Another time, ladies and gentlemen. Another time and another radio show. All right. not on this one. Okay, so I've got an MDQ story that I was privy to, and then I've got like a personal one that happened to me like in high school. It's not MDQ related exactly. I'll leave it to the room. Which one would you like to hear?
High school.
The high school?
I'll go
high school. All right. You guys have heard all my MDQ stories. So basically, in high school, the acting that I did, we ended up, I did stuff with a fine arts studio. Most of the stuff that we ended up doing were like these, like Ben-Hur, biblical, swashbuckler kind of like, I mean, it's crazy, everything, you know, so it was all like Bible related and all that. So I ended up being cast, being one of the older men in the group or whatever, you know. I ended up always being like Roman guard number two and bandit number two and, you know, whatever it was. So we were doing this one shoot just because I, you know, literally I was playing the muscle for all these plays basically. And we had this one sequence where my two good buddies were playing the leads in this particular show. They're like wandering through some canyon or whatever, and we're like they get mugged by these bandits. So I'm in my costume, which is like this sackcloth kind of like burlap thing, whatever, and I'm crawling over this giant. We've made a huge set. It's like covered in carpet. It looks like a rock face kind of thing, and I'm like crawling all around. I wish you guys could see me right now. I'm doing all the moves. I'm like stalking them on top of this set piece, and I, at the given moment, I'm supposed to leap off the stage and kind of like tackle my friend Jonathan, who's in the show. Well, unbeknownst to me at this point, my little burlap sack costume had like gotten under my foot, and I didn't know.
Oh,
so I like
no.
launch myself like I'm in a Marvel action movie, and I this thing's under my foot. I tear my costume, I rend it from top to bottom, and I face plant from like 4 feet up. I promise you. I mean, I don't know how I didn't like crack a rib or something. And so I literally just face plant like straight down, and my friend Jonathan like picks me up and like fights me on the stage. He's like holding me up, you know what I mean? And I have to like go off stage and limp back on stage for the next scene and then change into like the most wounded Roman soldier ever to be featured on the stage. And I was just like, oh, it was so funny. And time, there really, like, there's not a I basically fell off that landing and onto the stage in like no time at all.
Oh,
like I was
man.
There in a flash, and then I'm like on the ground, rolling, like
brutal.
It was funny. It was brutal. It was really. We actually had a viewing of the show after everything was done, the end of the season or whatever, and we didn't actually end up getting to the end of the show watching the tape because we rewound and watched me faceplant. It's almost as painful as the actual occurrence.
Oh my gosh. Adrian Visnick.
I can't beat that. Someone's
going to
hold
down
something. The board. Someone's going to be the perfect one here.
You've got some stuff about snapping on 1 and 3 that are just fine.
someone came to the show the other day. They were like, you're clapping very intense. Like, he's very musically inclined. He's like, everything was great, but like your clapping is like so intense.
He picked
like,
out your clapping.
Yeah, because he knew that I knew how to do everything else on the show, but I don't know how to clap on the 2 of the 4. Because apparently I think I'm like this like... pretty group, like, you know, again, pretty groovy person. Can clap and snap and do it. Oh yeah, wait, yeah, definitely didn't snap on the right timing, but thank goodness for David Lamoureux.
Well, yep. Now Michael, we are getting down to the end. Do you think we could beg these people for one more?
Yeah, I think we better.
I'll tell you what, let's go ahead and close out the show, and yep. We will ask them. Yeah, I'm very tired and I'm a little bit weary from all this fun that we've had, but I think I can toil on just a little bit, so we'll let them get set up here. And Michael, I want to thank you, man. What a fun time it is to sit across from you every single week.
And right back at you, Andrew.
We're going to play our outro here. We're going to tell people we appreciate them listening to State of the Arts. We're going to remind them to go see Million Dollar Quartet.
Yes, now through March 4th at the Cerritos Center for the Performing Arts. Go to 3DT shows or 3dtheatricals.org.
Obviously, Broadway entertainment here, accessible from Los Angeles. Get down there, go see this show. You won't miss these amazing people. You don't want to miss them even for a second because they really do some great work. Michael, a pleasure to see you. Where will I see you next week?
Next week on the radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Andrew David James, only on LA Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, peace in the valley.
Oh, well, I'm tired and so weary, but I must go along till the Lord comes and calls me away. Oh, yes, with the morning so bright and the Lamb is the light and the night that is as black as a sea of rest. There will be peace in the valley for me someday. There will be peace in the valley for me. Oh Lord, I pray. Well, there's no sadness
and no,
no sorrow.
There'll be
no trouble. Trouble I see. There'll be peace in the valley for me.
Ladies and gentlemen, the cast of Million Dollar Quartet, thanks for listening.